Hello and welcome to Comic Talk Today for Monday, May 21st, 2018. Of course, this is the episode of the week in which I talk about some of the best things that I read this weekend, the top of the pile. I gotta say, last week was a little bit of a light week for me. I probably only read like 12 or 15 books. I'm not going to be talking about all 12 or 15. I'm actually only going to be discussing six titles. We've got one from Aftershock, one from Dark Horse, one from Image, two from DC, and one from Marvel. So I guess I want to kick off with the Aftershock one, and that is A Walk Through Hell number one. This is written by Garth Ennis with art by Goran Suzuka, colors by Ives Gorsina, and letters by Rob Steen. And I talked quite a bit about this book on the Aftershock Central podcast. That episode came out last week, so shout out to Ronnie and Travis. And the discussion on this particular issue was a little interesting, because I think the issue that I had, and I know Ronnie had a lot of problems with this first issue, is that the story didn't quite kick off until probably the last, I would say maybe 4 or 5 pages. And that's a little jarring for a person who is trying to support an independent publisher who maybe feels like they want the first issue to really kick things off in high gear. And if you want to settle down with issues 2 and 3, then that's probably okay. But the first issue, you want to set up this whole world. You want to introduce the characters. You want to get into the meat of the story. And to me, I think this issue was mostly successful in doing that. But the problem with A Walk Through Hell was that there was a lot of setup leading up to the events that will actually take place in what we thought the story was. So basically, it takes place in, it looks like modern day, and we have some FBI detectives who are pursuing a couple of cases. They meet with another group of agents who are pursuing this case in the warehouse, which ultimately is what this miniseries will be about. And those two agents investigating in the warehouse go into the warehouse and they disappear. And so it is up to these other two agents, who look very much like Mulder and Scully from The X-Files, which is what I really dug about this. They need to find out what's going on. But along the way, they kind of get the feeling that maybe they shouldn't be there, but they don't really kind of care. So at this warehouse, there's a SWAT team who has gone in to investigate. They came out, and they're completely freaked out about what they saw inside. In fact, minor spoiler alert, they end up all killing each other inside the SWAT van. The cops that are there are also really freaked out because of all this craziness going on. But these FBI agents don't care. They go into the warehouse, and that's kind of where the issue ends. So all that seems really interesting, right? Except all that does take place in those last few pages of the issue. What we get in the first, I don't know, 15 pages is a setup on this whole world. And what I try to tell Ronnie is that it seems to me like maybe while right now what happens in the setup maybe doesn't quite jive with where the story is going to be going with issue 2, it is really good and it is really interesting. But it's not until we get to the next one that we'll see that. So for example, we see a massive shootout in a mall, and that leads to a gun control discussion. There's a bunch of tweets being put up on the page with no dialogue from the characters. We do see that one of these agents has very vivid nightmares about something that happened previously in the past. It looks like that might be a rape. So as a result, I understand why Ronnie wasn't a huge fan of this book. Because the thing is, Ronnie reads comics to be entertained, to enjoy superhero stories, or not even superhero stories, whatever stories actually is taking place. And this book is very much, God, I hate using the term, a slice of life book. Even though maybe it doesn't end up being that way. Because, you know, there is a lot of craziness going on today in politics, in society in general. There's school shootings all the time. There was just one recently, last week in Texas. So this stuff does actually happen. And I guess some people don't want that kind of thing in their comics, and I totally understand that. Because I think for a lot of people, the reason we watch TV or watch movies or read comics or read books or create art or whatever it might be is to escape from some of the shenanigans, we'll say, that happen in real life. And this doesn't do that. It very much puts the reader into a place that's very much like our own. Obviously with a crazy supernatural element that's going to be kicking off here. Overall, though, I thought it was really interesting. The art is absolutely gorgeous. I'm not very familiar with Goran Suzuka, but I really, really dug the art. It was gorgeous. Gorgeous art throughout. I did enjoy the fact that this is the kind of Garth Ennis that I'm used to reading. You know, I talked a little bit about his workbooks a couple of times in this podcast, and while I've been enjoying those, that's not generally what I like to see from Garth Ennis. I like the darker, grittier stuff. And in many respects, I think that this book could end up being something along the lines of Preacher, except maybe with a little more social commentary, or at least more in-your-face social commentary than Preacher did. So overall, I thoroughly enjoyed A Walk Through Hell number one. I think, especially now that I've had a few days to kind of digest what it is that I read, I enjoyed it more than I originally did when I spoke about it on that podcast. So for me, A Walk Through Hell number one is going to be a 4 out of 5. Thoroughly enjoyed it. Looking forward to reading the next issue. Now, I guess since we're kind of on the grittier side of things, I'll move on to Ether number one from Dark Horse. This is written by Matt Kent with art by David Rubin. Yeah, I talked a little bit about this when I did the Comic Predictor last week, how I really enjoyed the first one, and I didn't read it monthly as I was, you know, as it was coming out. I read the first issue and I liked it, but I kind of went by the wayside. And then as I was talking to Paul about it, I decided to go back and reread it. We recorded an episode, which I ended up looking it up. I think it ended up being on the Valiant Central feed, but I don't recall. So if you want to find that, you can go to nerdlegion.com. There's a little search box up top. You can just look up Ether and it'll show up on there. You'll see what episode it was. But it was a very interesting, I guess we could say, treatise into Matt Kent exploring magic. And here's the thing about Matt Kent. I know he said this in interviews before, so that's why I found this book kind of fascinating, is that Matt Kent has never been a fan of magic, right? He tries to ground all his books in reality. And I'm not talking about slice of life necessarily, or, you know, bringing in current events into the books like we just talked about with A Walk Through Hell. He likes to be able to explain things through science. At the time that Ether, the first Ether series came out, he had been charged with writing Shadow Man over at Valiant. And that has a lot more magical elements tied into it. And that's not something that he's very comfortable with. And so he wanted to explore how a person that's very much based in fact and science would deal with a magical world. Because in this book, we have the main character who does travel through this alternate realm called the Ether, where everything is magic, right? All the fairy tales are true. Magic is real. There's fairies, there's trolls, there's monsters, there's all kinds of stuff. And kind of how that impacts his life back here on Earth. And so as we learn through that, he spends pretty much all his time going to the Ether because he's very curious to know more about the Ether, right? He's a detective. So he looks at facts and tries to solve problems. As a result, that kind of led his life on Earth to be put by the wayside. So he was married with 2 kids, and he kind of pretty much abandons his family because as he goes to the Ether, time flows differently in the Ether than it does on Earth. So his wife is getting older, his kids are getting older, and they never see him because even though he might only be in the Ether for, say, a couple of days, it could be months back on Earth. And there's a lot of interesting psychological stuff that's going on with this character in that first series as well. In fact, one of the ways to enter the Ether is pretty much to attempt suicide, even though you're not really killing yourself if you know how to do it correctly. So when he wants to get into the Ether, he pretty much jumps off this building, and as he enters into this pool at the bottom of the building, it kind of triggers something in his brain that allows him to be transported into the Ether. Now, I guess there were people in the past who tried to do this and ended up actually dying as they were experimenting on how to figure this out. But I thought that was an interesting touch to put in here because of the way that his life on Earth contrasts directly his life in the Ether. So this second series, Ether the Copper Golems, picks up directly from that. And what's interesting about this one is that we do get to see a new aspect of his family life. Because there is an agency that is aware of the Ether, that have been investigating the Ether. And as it turns out, his daughter is the one that's in charge of that place. And the reason she joined the agency and wanted to get involved in this project is because she didn't have her father growing up. And so she figured by joining the agency, this would be one way for her to connect with her dad. Now, the connection's a little odd because he's very distant from reality. And you can see that when we have scenes on Earth and then in the Ether, whereas on Earth, he's very gloomy and dark and doesn't say a whole lot. He doesn't talk to people, really. But when he's in the Ether, he's extremely happy-go-lucky. And, you know, you can see that also in the way that the art changes slightly. the way that the colors are different as well, right? So on Earth, the colors are very dark and grim, while on the ether, it's very bright and vibrant. We do get the setup for what this new miniseries will be, and we do get to see some characters from the first series pop up again here. So after the events of the first series, there were these copper golems that are kind of breaking into Earth. Okay, they're bridging the rift into Earth, and it's causing problems around the world. And so he needs to find a way to stop the copper golems from entering Earth so that all that is fixed here. And the deal that it's made is kind of interesting, right? Before he finds out that his daughter is the one that he's talking to at the agency, she's like, look, we'll provide for your family for the rest of their lives. We'll give you all the resources you need. And he agrees that he needs to fix this mistake. Now, what's interesting is that he wants to fix the mistake of elements of the ether coming to Earth, but ultimately, it is the ether that has caused all the problems for himself back on Earth. So I like that we're getting back into that. And I'm sure at some point in the series, things will get a little bit darker as they get touched upon and in how that relates together. Because I remember reading the first one, and one of the issues was extremely dark when we started learning a lot about his past. And I'm sure we're going to get to see that again with a fresh perspective now that his daughter is somewhat involved in his life. Overall, I really dug this one. And I think this first issue is actually much stronger than the first series first issue. And maybe the reason for that is now that I have a lot of background information on these characters, I kind of understand where it's going. But I have seen some people talk about this book where they didn't feel like it kind of clicked for them. And I do feel like the reason for that is you kind of have to have read the first Ether miniseries in order to kind of understand what's happening here. Because otherwise, there's a lot of jumping back and forth. With that said, though, I think Matt Kent does do that quite a bit, where he will jump a lot in places in the story, but on purpose, because as the story is revealed, you're supposed to be putting the pieces together. Overall, I thought this was a great first issue, though. I'm going to give this one another 4 out of 5. And I guess since we're on the magical realm thing, I want to briefly talk about the new challengers from DC. This is part of the New Age of Heroes line that's stemming out of DC Metal, which I still haven't talked about. You know what? I'm not even going to talk about it. It was a thing. It happened. This is written by Scott Snyder and Aaron Gillespie. My assumption is Scott Snyder is doing the plotting and Gillespie is actually doing the writing. Andy Kubert doing pencils, Klaus Janson on inks, Brett Anderson on colors, and Darren Bennett on letters. Fantastic team, by the way. This is like heavy hitters on this new Challengers team. And of course, this is a fresh new take on Kirby's Challengers of the Unknown. And I think it does pay a nice homage to a lot of those stories. We do learn quite a bit about the Challengers. We learn through the professor who is in charge of the Challengers. We learn who the Challengers are, who they have been. We learn that there have been many teams over the years. And, you know, there are some changes made to kind of coincide with what's happening in the DC Universe after DC Metal. But the Challengers are still going to be a team in charge of solving the mysteries of the universe, kind of at the edge of the known universe, right? Because now that the source wall is open as a result of what happened in DC Metal, there's much more of the universe to explore than we had before. And what's cool is we do learn that all the characters, this is not really a spoiler because it's told pretty early on, all the characters that are being made part of this new Challengers team by the professor they're all dead. They all died as a result of doing something generally heroic. One character in particular was pretty interesting, who's a Spiral agent, and we've seen Spiral in the Nightwing book quite a bit. He's a Spiral agent, and you know, the whole time you're like, this guy is going to be the leader of the team, but then something happens and you're like, oh, okay, well, that kind of explains what the Challengers are about. Maybe this guy won't be the head of the team, and he won't be. In fact, he will not be a part of the team, period. It was really interesting to read, though. I think the dialogue itself was a little disjointed for me. I think that's generally the case for a lot of the stuff that Snyder's been writing, at least recently, where maybe things don't feel like kind of they go together. But I think in particular for this book, that worked better for me than it has for other books that he's written recently. So I thoroughly enjoyed it. The art is really great, by the way. Andy Kubert's, you know, he's been in the industry for a long time, so I'm still enjoying his art. This is really something fantastic and special, and there is a lot of setup still. So if you can get through some of this setup that's been going on this issue, I think this will start paying off. I don't know, maybe the next issue, but maybe one more down the line. depending on how Snyder and Anderson decide to take the story. But I do like the villain that's introduced at the beginning. We didn't get to see much more of him later on. I do like the setup of the Challengers, the way that they're doing a fresh new take on it, and kind of the caveat that the Challengers have when solving these mysteries, because they can't quite enter the real world, right? They're dead. So they have a countdown timer on their uniforms, a little hourglass, and once they leave the Challenger's Mountain, the hourglass starts counting down. And if they don't get issue solved and get back to the mountain in time, then they die because they're already dead, right? And so being part of the Challengers just gives them kind of a second lease on life. Really interesting premise. Thoroughly enjoyed it. There's quite a few quibbles that I have here and there in the way that the story was paced. There's some things that kind of didn't make sense as to why they were put in here to begin with. But I really, really like this first issue. I think this could be a worthy contender for something interesting and exciting going forward that is connected to the DC Universe proper, but not quite completely intertwined in terms of bringing in characters we know and love. Like, there's an appearance of Superman's in here, Wonder Woman, Cyborg, and three of the Green Lanterns. So that was cool, but we'll see how this ends up going. Overall, though, I thought it was a solid first issue. This was going to be a 3.5 out of 5 for me. I guess while we're on the DC front, I have to talk about what I think I've said is my favorite book, or one of my top 2 or 3 books that I read every month, and that's The Wildstorm number 13. This is, of course, written by Warren Ellis with art by John Davis Hunt, and this is the beginning of a new arc, if I'm not mistaken. So a lot of the characters that we've seen throughout the first 12 issues are not necessarily here, except for the Weatherman up in Stormwatch. So, you know, that's cool. We do get a lot more back and forth on this corporate espionage thing that's going on, this battle between agencies, between the Weatherman and an IO down on Earth. Of course, that has been a central plot of the first 12 issues, how these two agencies are kind of battling each other, and how this third team, led by Lord Emp, is kind of stuck in the middle. We do get to see that Weatherman is a total douche, by the way. And if we hadn't figured it out by the first 12 issues, then maybe you're not reading this carefully enough. But we see here he is truly, genuinely evil. And I really love that about this series. You know, I remember reading back in the day the Wildstorm stuff, and the Weatherman does end up being a bad guy. But I think the way that it's been handled here, where he's kind of pretty much set up as a bad guy from the beginning, leading an agency that's not bad, by the way. Because Stormwatch does a lot of great research into furthering technology for humanity. But of course, him being the leader of this group, he is able to use that to his advantage. And it's played up a little bit here, right? He's sending a mission to Mars, and it only takes him a week. And, you know, he's talking with his assistant about how, well, back down on Earth, like, it still takes him years to get to Mars. We can get there in a week. So that was cool. I think the most interesting part about this is seeing John Lynch show up on here, because this is one of the most interesting aspects of, I think, the original Wildstorm universe, and I think this will be a thread that connects quite a few elements that we've been seeing throughout the first 12 issues. Now, of course, John Lynch used to be the leader of IO, right? He's not anymore now. In this book, it's Kraven, and I think that's cool. It's really well done. But John Lynch is out looking for people that he used to work for, and apparently he's been keeping tabs on. And the person that we see in this particular issue is Colonel Mark Slayton, who fans of the Wildstorm universe may remember as Backlash. And Backlash back then used to be all over the place. He was great. He was a trainer at Stormwatch. He had his own book. He has ties to other characters that we met, for example, Michael Cray. He and Michael Cray used to be in Team 7 with John Lynch and a few other folks. And I like the fact that Mark Slayton is very different in this book. So I remember Backlash being a great team leader, you know, like super logical, very well-versed, like awesome fighting prowess. He had these cool tendrils, like the Omega Red tendrils, popped out of his wrists. Of course, everything in this book is a reimagining of the original Wildstorm universe. And the Mark Slayton in this book is very different. He's very angry. He's very reserved. And he is he has decided to step away from society. After he retired from this project that they're talking about in this particular issue, he retired to a farm in the middle of nowhere. And it was really cool, by the way, because John Lynn just talking to Mark, and he's like, hey, like, why the hell would you come live in a farm in the middle of nowhere? You used to love being around people. And he's like, look, Slayton, he's like, I'm supposed to be in a farm. And he goes through, like, the etymology of the name Slayton and what it means. And it goes back to, like, Old English, pretty much like somebody who lives in a farm in the middle of nowhere. Like, that's pretty much what Slayton means. And I thought that was so fascinating because I'm a huge language nerd, and I love going back and, like, trying to dissect roots of words and see where they come from. And the fact that, you know, Warren Ellis made this name mean something, like, literally mean what this guy is doing in life, was really interesting to me. I also like the way that his story has changed, because while he's always had these tendrils, and the whole history of Mark Slayton in the original universe is a little odd. He's like thousands of years old. He was born in Atlantis, right? Like, I think his mom was Atlantean, and Atlantis is like an alien colony for the Cherubim, who are the people that Emp and all the Wildcats are part of. His dad is a Cherubim, and so he had these latent abilities. But throughout time, he's lost a lot of his memory, so he doesn't remember, like, a lot of his previous lives, even though he's led a bunch, right? He's been, like, a ninja, he's been a secret spy, he's been in World War II, like, all kinds of stuff. Now, that's not hinted at here, but the way that they've changed it is that Lynch discovered this genetic code of the Cherubim, like, around the world in ancient artifacts, and started experimenting on people. And as a result, Backlash, or Mark Slayton as he's known here, by his real name, he gained these abilities. Because Team Zero was the first team, this, you know, agent team, covert team for the government, was the first team to have superpowers. Right, it was the predecessor to, like, Gen 12, Gen 13. Of course, Gen 13 being a huge book for Wildstorm back in the 90s. In fact, Burnout, who's a member of that team, is John Lynch's son. I think, who was it? No, never mind. Michael Cray's daughter wasn't in Gen 13. I think she was a member of the Deviant 8, which was kind of like the evil version of Gen 13. Anyway, so here, it's a little different, and Mark Slayton has gotten this psychosis, because by being implanted with a genetic code, it's like he's got a second person living inside him, like an alien mind living inside him as a result of this genetic code. And we do see that physically as a manifestation towards the end of the issue when he looks into the mirror and sees himself as an alien. But he's talking to that alien. And I know I talked about this a little bit, was it last week or the week before, when I talked about Venom number one? And in some respects, it feels like that, right? Like, he's possessed by this alien symbiote thing that gives him his abilities. But we don't get to see a lot of that here, right? Whereas in Venom, it was explored throughout the first issue. Of course, these powers kind of made him crazy, right? Having somebody in your head at all times, I would assume, would make you crazy. And he has kind of become somewhat of a serial killer, because his alien genes give him this hunger for blood, I guess. And so he kills people in order to feed that, and apparently sends their bodies up into space. That's not quite explained how that works, but I thought it was really well done. I love seeing this, like, evil Mark Slayton show up here, and thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it. So what I did enjoy, of course, is all those ties into Team 7 has me wondering how this will affect Michael Cray. Because we did see in the first arc that when Michael Cray tried to kill Lord Emp, he had something that kind of disabled Emp's abilities. And maybe it has to do with this whole experimentation by John Lynch. I gotta say, every time I read this, I just love it. Because the way that Warren Ellis is reinventing things just makes it so cool and different. And fits so well into this corporate espionage thing that we've been setting up for the past 12, 13 issues. So, man, the Wildstorm number 13, thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it. Fascinating issue. This has got to be a 5 out of 5. I want to talk about an Image book next, and that is Flavor number 1. This is written by Joseph Keating, with art by Wook Jin Clark, colors by Tamron Bonvillain, and letters by Ariana Mayer. And special consultant Ali Buzari. So let me explain this. This is kind of a cooking comic. And don't tune out yet. Just listen. There's a cooking comic. And Ali Buzari is a chef. And somehow or other, Joseph Keating has brought in Ali Buzari to be a food consultant for this book. Now, that's not completely explained how that works in the issue itself. There is some back matter in which the writer interviews the chef, and they talk a little bit about how food connects with comics, the creativity and all that. And I appreciated that because I love cooking. I love cooking. If I had found my cooking calling 20 years ago, I may have become a chef myself. I just love the fact that you can take a bunch of raw, random things and make something not just taste great, but if you're really, like, we'll just say anal about your cooking, you can make it look beautiful as well. And you can make some really interesting combinations. I'm finding that now that I've become kind of a vegetarian, where I have to be a lot more creative with my ingredients in order to make something that I'll be able to eat, but also enjoy eating, right? Because one of the great things about, say, going to a restaurant is not necessarily the food, but the experience of the food. I mean, you can sit down at home and grill some burgers or whatever, you know, make, pasta or, like, you know, whatever. Open up a can of Chef Boyardee. Like, that's eating, right? But there's a way to make that into an experience. I remember listening to Geek Brunch some time ago. They kept on joking about this umami thing, right? And shout out to Mike and Bill for that. But umami is a thing, right? It's like the fifth flavor, right? It's like a new sense of taste. And I think this book kind of will maybe play with some of that. There's not a whole lot of food talk here because we're setting up what the story is. And the story is, it's odd, but very familiar. So it takes place in this town, and this girl has been the cook at her family restaurant because her parents are both disabled, and so they can't do a whole lot in the restaurant itself. She's been pretty much running things, her and her dog, who's, he can't talk, and he's not, like, you know, anthropomorphic per se. He's just a dog, but he can read books, apparently, all written in ruff-ruff, in dog language. He helps her around the house and around the kitchen. And, of course, the restaurant's not doing very well. And there's some kind of thing in this society where it seems like maybe the government kind of steps in to help businesses. And they've enlisted her uncle to come from another town to be a caretaker for her and her parents in order to help the restaurant succeed. And that's pretty much the start of the story. Okay, in a nutshell, we do learn a lot about the personalities of these characters, who they are, what they're about, what they enjoy doing, what they hate doing. We do learn that the uncle's kind of a D-bag, I guess we could say, but he's there because he's going to be getting paid by the government to be the caretaker. And the girl's not too happy about it. I think her name is Zoom. She's not very happy about it because, of course, she's been running the restaurant by herself mostly because of her parents' disabilities. And this government social welfare person is just like, listen, you're still underage. Like, I don't care what you think you knew and don't know. This is the way it is, and this is what we're going to do. So the uncle has to be there for 3 months, which at the end of the 3 months, they'll go back and do another interview and see if, like, he needs to stay there or if, like, things are back to normal, whatever it might be. Really interesting premise. I didn't know what to expect with flavor. I do hope that based on the back matter, this book does turn more into an adventure in cooking. And I know that may sound weird and it may turn off a lot of people into this book, but I thought it was really well done. You know, looking at the cover and looking at the interior art, it seems like it would be something I wouldn't want to read. The art style tends to lean more like a YA book would, or maybe like a comic based on a cartoon from, like, I don't know, Cartoon Network or whatever else might be. It's like a sort of anime-ish, like Attack of the Titans type of art style. But it was really well done, and I enjoyed it. And I think it goes a long way into furthering the story, because this is a fun world, even though there's kind of not fun stuff happening. It's a fun world, and I thoroughly enjoyed reading it. So, flavor number one from Image Comics. If you didn't think about picking this up, I recommend you do. I was very pleasantly surprised. I'm going to go ahead and give this one a 4 out of 5. I have two more books I want to talk about. The last single-issue comic, and then I'll talk about a trade that I read, is Cable, number 157, written by Lonnie Landler and Zach Thompson, Art by Jimmer Peralta, colors by Jesus Abortov, and letters by Travis Lenham. First thing I want to say about this is I love how creative Lonnie and Zach are getting with the Cable story. Because all these issues that they've done, I think there's been three out so far that they've done, they all take place in between already established Cable stories. For example, the beginning of this issue takes place immediately after Cable 541 from 93. They mention when Cable and X-Men fought, and Cable almost killed X-Men, and that was in Cable 30. And I enjoy that. I like that these guys are filling in these in-between stories. Because it makes perfect sense for a character like Cable to have more of these stories than others, I would say. And the reason for that is he's a time traveler. And so there's a lot going on within the time stream itself that lends well to this type of story. So, of course, this one, I assumed would be a little wacky, and it was, because Cable is in possession of X-Man, right? Who is kind of himself, but not really. They're half-brothers. X-Man was kind of like a Cable that was experimented on by Mr. Sinister, who's a character that I really love, and I hope that we see some Sinister in this book. But they are still trying to get away from Metis, who's the techno-organic being that's kind of almost like a physical manifestation of the virus that Cable has within himself. And as a result, after a fight, they end up going to kind of the end of time. And it's not just X-Men and Cable that go there. There's other Cables from other time streams that end up going to this end of time place. And part of the reason is, yes, to get away from Metis, but they need to find a way to defeat Metis. And I love the whole play between, I think it was like four or five different Cables, and how they don't trust each other, even though they're the same person, how they have different backgrounds and, you know, different life experiences that lead them to make different choices. Of course, that makes perfect sense because this is ultimately a time travel book. And, you know, a lot of people kind of hate time travel stuff because it can get really, I guess the good phrase is timey-wimey, to use a Doctor Who thing. Things can get complicated with time travel, right? Because if you change one thing, how does that impact everything after it? If you change that and the future has changed and you go back and rechange it, will that go back to the beginning? Or, you know, there's a lot of weird stuff when you start thinking about time travel. But I think Lonnie and Zach do a really good job at not making it not make sense. And I think this issue reads a lot kind of like, it's one of those like sci-fi horror movies where like they're stuck in a spaceship or a space station and like the monster attacks, right? I'm trying to think of what would be a good one. It's like not necessarily aliens, although maybe there's like a little bit of alien stuff in here. Something like Event Horizon. This issue reminded me a lot of Event Horizon. Because there's crazy stuff that happens here, right? And ultimately, the distrust between all these Cables leads them to figure out who is not actually a Cable and is actually Metis gone to the future. Now, of course, we do get some more stuff going on about this mystery of Metis and why Cable maybe doesn't want to kill him. Now, I'm not convinced as to what the reason is, but it seems like maybe Metis is possibly a Cable, or at least an outgrowth of Cable himself. And X-Men starts to kind of see that. He's like, he dives into Cable's mind. He's like, you know, that's why this is happening. Why don't you tell everybody else? And Cable's like, I can't do that. We cannot kill him right now. So ultimately, I think there will be a major mystery that somehow plays into this overall arc, in which will take probably many issues to see, right? Because we're only getting little bits and pieces of each issue as we progress. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. The art is fantastic in this. I love the crazy techno-organic stuff that happens. You know, Zach and Lonnie are big fans of body horror stuff, so it works well with this book in particular. Overall, thoroughly liked it. 4 out of 5 for me. Next issue will have the original X-Force in the story. I guess Cable and X-Men will travel back into the 90s before X-Force was killed. And I very much look forward to seeing that. Because looking at the preview page that they showed, it looks like they're pretty much taking it right off the page. The art style, the feeling of the 90s. So I very much look forward to seeing that. Again, that's Cable 157, 4 out of 5. The last thing I want to mention Very briefly, I'm going to talk about it, is a book that was introduced to me by Mike Myers from Geek Brunch podcast. I already mentioned him once on this podcast, but shout outs to Mike for that. And that book is called Cul-de-Sac, and it is written by Andrew Shaw with art by Will Playden. And I'm going to have Andrew and Will come on this podcast in a few weeks. We'll do a Therapy Thursday episode to talk about kind of this stuff. And I'm assuming other things that will really interesting me, because Cul-de-Sac is it's an oversized trade. It's like, I think, 90 pages, 80 pages, something like that. Here's the thing. I'm going to preface before I talk about the book itself. Andrew and Will are in Australia. So the way to get this book is through their Etsy store. It's like $11 for it. The problem is if you're in the U.S., shipping to the U.S. from Australia is going to run you roughly $20. So you're going to end up paying like $35 for this book if you want to get it. Now, from my understanding, talking to Andrew a little bit, they do want to bring this digitally. So if you want to hang on to whenever that happens, I recommend that you do pick it up. I will say, though, if you are a fan of things like The Twilight Zone, The Outer Limits, if you love like the EC Comics, Tales from the Crypt, or like any of those weird like anthology type movies or TV shows, comics, this is right up your alley. I was so pleasantly surprised when I read this. There are multiple stories in this. Like I said, it's an anthology horror book, but all the stories actually somehow tie into one another. Well, the majority of them do. Not all of them. And I thought that was really, really well done. Because the one thing about anthologies, in particular from like the 50s and 60s, when this was like a big genre, is that they were all self-contained. And you could read any of these self-contained. I mean, each of the stories are maybe like 5 or 6 pages. But there is kind of like a little thread connecting everything. So for example, in like Tales from the Crypt Keeper, or Tales from the Crypt, you had the Crypt Keeper, and that was kind of the connecting thread throughout all the stories. I was just so impressed by this. The art is freaking gorgeous. It is gorgeous. I haven't talked to them about how they did this, but it looks like it's maybe painted or watercolors of some sort. If not, the way that they rendered it really makes it look like that. And it works really, really well for a horror comic, but because it does give you that like grit and sense of danger that you're supposed to get from these type of stories. And there's like misshapen people, and like there's zombies, and there's plant monster things, and there's murder and ghosts, and there was so much incredible stuff in here. I'm not going to go in depth, like I said. Once I have Andrew and Will on, we'll go in depth into this book. If you're a fan of that kind of stuff, I know there's been some resurgence in anthology stuff on TV lately, with you know, like American Horror Story. What's the other one? There's one on Sci-Fi. I can't remember what it's called. But there's a few series out now that are trying to tap back into this anthology theme of the 50s and 60s. But, you know, in particular, if you love Twilight Zone, Outer Limits, Tales from the Crypt, that kind of thing, which I love. In fact, I've been rewatching The Twilight Zone lately. Once I get through, I think it's like 5 or 6 seasons, I can't remember. Once I get through all of those, I'm going to go and redo Outer Limits, both the original and the remake of the 90s. It's just, man, I love this kind of stuff. And of course, I'm a big horror fan, so, you know, it makes sense. And I think we need more of this kind of stuff. You know, I talk about this. We need more anthology comics because there's so very few, right? I talked, well, not on this podcast, and maybe I should have, but I read Shock from Aftershock, and that was an anthology, oversized hardcover anthology series or one-shot book, and it was fantastic. You know, Image used to have one. Dark Horse used to have one. You've got some stuff like 2000 AD that's kind of like an anthology. You've got, I think Alterna's putting out a quarterly anthology right now. So there is some interest in it, but, you know, in comics, it doesn't happen that much anymore. I think we're seeing it a lot more in TV, and I hope that translates into us seeing more of this kind of comic. Because I think it's really great and interesting to have, like, really short one-and-done stories where you don't have to go in-depth about anything, but it does require a great deal of skill to tell those kind of stories, because you're supposed to kind of establish the world and the characters and the premise all in a very short period of time. And maybe a lot of times the reason why some comics fail to do that properly is because maybe they take too much time doing the setup. And these short anthologies don't have that problem. You're kind of in and out. And you don't have a lot of, you know, like baggage of previous stories or thinking about where the story will go next. And they always have some kind of moral as well, right? In many ways, they're kind of like modern day fairy tales. And I just really love that. So again, that's Cul-de-Sac. This is some Shaw Mill Comics. I'll put a link to the Etsy shop in the show notes if you want to pick it up. I know that there were a few people once I talked about this. I think I tweeted about it, and I talked to some friends of mine on Discord. And there's been quite a bit of interest on this particular book. So if you get a chance, if you don't mind spending $20 on shipping from Australia, then I highly, highly recommend you get this. I'm telling you, this was, so far this year, this is the best horror book that I've read. And it might even be into last year. I don't know. I'd have to think about that. There's quite a bit of good horror content coming out. You know, Harrow County's out. I think that's ending soon. Infidel's been really great. I talked about Teether. Just a lot of stuff. And this was, it took me really by surprise. Really, really by surprise. So Cul-de-Sac, if you couldn't imagine, it's a 20 out of 5 for me. It's something really special. So if you can, give this one a shot. And I think that is going to wrap this episode up. Thanks for listening to the Top of the Pile episode of Comic Talk today. If you want to get in touch with me, at Geekvine is the best place on Twitter. You can email me, of course, comictalktoday@gmail.com. And this podcast is available on all your favorite podcatchers. Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn. What am I missing? iHeartRadio. I'm sure there's more. Thanks for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with a rant. I'll catch you then.